device. Following incident took place.
The Adam Echa, concerning a particular person, Shahai Masalek Merushuso Lerushusa Rabu. He was clearing stones from his private domain, from his personal property, to the public domain. Umatzo Chasid Echad, and a Chasid, what's a Chasid? A pious person, I guess, for want of a better translation, found him. So this guy's heaving these stones into the public area, and this Chasid comes upon him. Amarlo, he says to him, Reika, you fool. Mipnei ma ata mesalek merushus she'ena shelcha, lirushus shelcha. Why are you removing stones from an area, from a domain that is not yours, to a domain that is yours? So what's wrong with that question? Should we go that round? Question is, why are you removing? Question should be, why are you removing from what is yours to what's not yours? He asked the question, why are you removing from what isn't yours to what is yours? So, Liglei Alav, the owner of the property scoffed. He laughingly dismissed the chassid. Liyamin Nitzrach Limkor Sedehu. After a period of time, he needed to sell his property. So in other words, he got into difficulty and he had to dispose of the property. And then, having been forced to vacate his property, he was walking in that same public domain. And he stumbled on the same stones that he had removed. Amar, and then he said, Yafe Amar li oso chasid. That pious person spoke well, he spoke fittingly to me when he said, Mipnei ma ata mesalek merushus she'ena shelcha lirushus shelcha. For what reason did you remove stones from an area that wasn't yours to an area that was yours? So, what this chazal, I believe, shows is that we live in a world where we are inherently interconnected. In other words, the assumption of this property owner is that you've got this very clear distinction between the private domain, what he owns, and the public domain out there, which he doesn't own. But what his experience shows him is that what happens out there, in the end, directly impacts him. He stumbles on the stones. Now, I came across a story, which I've told to various businesses, which I think gets us across. It's a story about a guy, it's a true story, a guy who has a holiday home in KZN, in a beautiful part of that region. And he was going there, he was there one summer, and he went for a swim in the local lagoon, something he'd done for years. And he comes out the lagoon, and he stands on a piece of submerged rock. Cuts his foot, gets in his car, drives home, takes a shower, washes off the blood, doesn't think anything more of it. A few hours later, he starts to feel violently sick. He manages to get himself to the local doctor. The doctor miraculously is able to diagnose his condition. He's been attacked by a vicious flesh-eating bacteria. The reason why it's so miraculous is because the week before, the same doctor treated another patient with the same condition and he died from it. But for that reason, the doctor is able to recognize it so quickly. So he puts him in an ambulance, rushes him off to hospital, where they have to amputate his leg, firstly under the knee, then over the knee. He loses a couple of fingers, comes very close to losing his life. And in the end, Baruch Hashem, his condition stabilizes. Now, it turns out that almost certainly the reason why you had this vicious flesh-eating bacteria in the river is that upstream you have this rural community and they don't have sewage facilities. So what do people do when they don't have sewage facilities? What do they do with their raw sewage? Chuck in the river. They don't have a choice. So that story to me seemed so potently to sum up what we in South Africa call the challenge of sustainability. Because you've got two worlds. You've got a world which is comfortable and affluent, which is increasingly multiracial. And then you have a world which is impoverished, which is desperate, which doesn't have jobs. Viktor Frankl talked about futurelessness, the state of people having no sense of hope. Now, if we think that these two worlds can just exist in parallel without the second impacting on the first, we're living in a false paradise. One world. Now, I think, in a way, that's the depth of this chazal. What chazal are telling us is that the world is interconnected. So I've given you an example, and I've tried to relate it to our South African context. But you can relate it to any context of the world. That's the challenge of sustainability. So how does this relate to the role of a company? The company can't be an amoral entity. If the traditional view of the company was the business of business is business, and you've just got to do you mind just closing the door, sir? And you've just got to focus on maximizing shareholder wealth. Well, that doesn't work. Because if the society is failing, your business can't succeed. You can't have a business without a country. So you were saying, are we talking about big corporates? Probably. I think the bigger the corporate, the more you're able, in a sense, to lift your head above the turret and look at that bigger picture. But if you look at South Africa today, you'll see very much this is what corporates are doing. You look at something like the CEO Initiative. You familiar with the CEO Initiative? Some of the leading CEOs in the country, from the leading companies, so they've come together and like
captains to
captains of the industry. Captains of industry have come together, including some of the Jewish ones like Stephen Kosoff, Adrian Gore, Brian Joffe, and they've developed these different streams. You know, one is about youth employment, another one is about promoting entrepreneurship. This is going beyond the business of business is business.
But you know what I must say, it's not altruistic. Because it's going, they're doing that because business, the business of business is business.
Right.
Okay? Actually, by taking care of those factors, it helps your business. That's why you're not doing it because it's the right thing to do.
So today, we're running back to this chazal. Here's a guy who throws his, he says, I don't care about what's going on out there. He throws the Rishon Rabbim. And in the end of the day, what's the Mishkan, the Gemara? He trips on those same stones. That's my point. It's not about being, I'm not being, what's the word? I'm not being like soft-hearted and sentimental at all. Pure in life and self-interest. This is my point. It doesn't matter what your views are.
The motivation doesn't matter.
The reality, okay, we can hold discussion in another discussion about motivation. But for the purposes of this point, what I'm trying to get across is that the way the world is created is that we are inherently interconnected. Therefore, what happens out there will impact us. In other words, the distinction between the private realm and the public are blurred. If that's the case, if what out there will impact me, I have to take responsibility for it. And I'm suggesting to you that this is the context for why the whole view of the business of business is business is now a bankrupt one. Business has to take their own model.
In South Africa, that's what it's doing.
That's why, for example, you'll see a business increasingly they challenge the government. How effective it is another story. But a couple of years ago, business leaders never criticized the government over corruption. At the end of last year, when they wanted to fire the then finance minister, you had 81 CEOs who signed a statement to defend him. Now, you know, you can say, well, it didn't work. That's not the point. What I'm saying is that there is the shift. You can't just look at maximizing shareholder value in a narrow sense. Is this the big... Yeah, it probably is. You look at the business models of individual companies.
What do you think about Discovery?
They have a model called shared value. You familiar with it? It was a model developed by a Harvard Business School academic, Michael Porter, a few years ago. And the basic idea is that companies have to look at how to address societal needs while making profits. That's the basic idea. The two go together. Because if you don't, then the society will be a threat to you. If you do, then there's actually hidden value that you're not discovering. That's Discovery's whole business model is based on that. Their model is to promote wellness or health in society. And through that, we make money. In a way, that's a variation of the same idea. You see that? You're going beyond the business of business as business. So that's the first paradigm I wanted to share with you. Good? Okay. I don't know about beautiful, but there you go. Here's a second one. Let me... Yes, of course.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but on this point of giving authenticity, is it not, when you're giving to a doctor, not that there's different rating scales, if you will, there's giving a guy a job, but then there's also in terms of who you should give to.
Yeah.
Start with your family, then it gets further out, and then ring ones and wireless.
Yeah.
It's not to say that...
It's called Dina Kadima, the laws of precedence.
Precedence. So it's not to say that giving to your family is not... Again, is it... I think it's the same idea, but you might as well be closer to home. So, like what we're talking about, exactly what you said, the Discovery of this win-win model, that they, I mean, another example, Nando's, for this ESR-funded recruitment company called Harambee, which does, they take guys who come from disadvantaged backgrounds, not their fine jobs. Nando's ended up taking this one as a pet project, and what resulted is that they started recruiting through this company, and they found that the staff that they were hiring were much better. So it was self-serving, that being said, it doesn't take away from how altruistic it is. The same way as if you were to give your family, it is, you could say it's somewhat self-serving, but it's not. It's still...
Look, there is a concept. The Harambee is a very interesting initiative. I mean, that, by the way, was a catalyst for what's called the YES Initiative, which is this youth employment scheme, which is part of the CEO initiative. It came from Harambee. That's a great example of a win-win. That's why it started. Because they said, it was actually the people at Yellowwoods, which owns Nando's and Hollow. They said, we can't get people to work for us. We have the right skills. It's a problem. How can we run our business? They're deeply invested in South Africa. They own all sorts of companies. So they said, we have to come up with a way to train them. And then that then was the inspiration for the YES program, which I know Stephen Kosoff is very involved with. So, I think it does go, but I would suggest as well
that it starts from the small little entrepreneur. It's not just for the big corporates, because it's all relative.
Yeah.
And it still has a consequence. So the little entrepreneur with his small stock still can make a big difference.
Yes.
So, you know, it's not what they say when you're making judges, the judges of the tens, the tens of 50, tens of 100. You've still got your little part, and in your little part, you have a role to play that affects you and it affects your society.
Could be. I think the bigger corporates have more resources.
That's just a bigger ripple. But the smaller one can, because there's so many things that makes a difference of those relations, how you treat people,
and
the consequences for your society is tremendous.
Yeah, so I think that's a good point. I mean, I'll give you one example. Speaks to that was the head of ethics for one of the big banks. She told me the following story. People are involved with the big banks. I think it's relevant to what you're saying about small companies. There was a guy who, an employee of the bank, who was consistently late for work. He was due to start work at 8 o'clock. And he arrived at 8:30. So the manager decided to fire him. You're late. So this ethics officer, she intervened. Because this guy lived so far away from work that he had to take 4 taxis to get there. And he had to leave his home at 4:30 in the morning. So what that meant was that if he missed one of the 4 taxis, he could easily be 30 minutes late. Now, from the manager's point of view, you're contracted to work from 8 o'clock in the morning to 5 o'clock in the afternoon. What happens between 5 and 8 o'clock the following morning is not my business. You're late. You have to go.
And he has to set an example to the rest of the staff.
And he has to set an example in all of those calculations. Now, that approach is very much the business of business is business. I hire you 8 till 5. But the ethics officer who intervened to save the guy's job says you can't do that because there's a broader context. You know what I mean? I don't know if you know this, but in South Africa, you know how much workers spend on their transport? 40% of their wages. So, you know, you have people who are earning small wages and they're spending 40% of it getting to and from work plus many hours every day. So there are no easy answers or solutions to that. But perhaps, and this is what raises your point, Dave, you know, the point is that in one's own area of influence, in terms of the people one interacts with, there needs to be more of a sensitivity. So what you can't have someone who's always late. I mean, I get that. But in a situation where a person is traveling like this, and he's no fault of his own, maybe as a manager, you have to have more sensitivity and more farsightedness.
But often you see, like, if there's social responsibility in a business, right? So first of all, there's policies and procedures, and you can't just fire somebody.
Right.
So when it came to the guy that found that the manager fired him, he just can't out of hand fire him. Okay. There would have been numerous warnings, etc., to get to that final stage, right? So often the part, the social responsibility works both ways. That sometimes the employee can say, no, I do have this issue. Maybe we have to...
Yeah. So I don't know the details of the case. I hear it.
So it's not just business.
But I don't know if those processes take that into account. I don't know. I don't know. Just an example. And this back to the last point, just related to what you're saying, is that we're talking about more than CSI. CSI is charity. That's what CSI is, corporate charity. CSI is a company gives 2% or whatever, and then that's it. But it's peripheral. It's something which is on the margins of the business. We talk with the whole shared value approach is to say, how do you merge the financial and social value proposition? How do you make that it's an integral part of your business model? You see the shift?
Just to create, in that analysis of my own CSR, I'm saying it might very well be fundamental to what it is, but I do understand what you're saying.
They've used it in a broader way. They're an example of a company that goes way beyond CSR.
So the sweet spot here, your example, staff from that company that were coming late, if you set up a taxi service which ended up being profitable, that's the sweet spot, because now you've addressed the social aspect of it, but it's also sustainable because it's business is business is business, which effectively means, to me, means sustainability. You're not in it to make loss, you're in it to make money, which
you also to benefit more motivated staff which come on time, also, exactly. So you have to think about it, how it works in different situations, and there often are trade-offs and there are complexities. But the point is that there's a shift in the paradigm. It's not the business of business
to
business.
There hasn't been a shift in the government paradigm.
Okay, so that's another story.
Because it doesn't filter through the other way. The companies are trying to take on their corporate responsibility. The government is squandering stuff that now says, what do you get for your tax money? You don't get anything. I'd say you have a problem.
This is all about companies taking direct action. You're right. If the government, there's a big problem in South Africa, if the government gets to a certain stage of corruption and destructiveness, then the whole place will go up.
Right?
Then
you try
to, but you have to look at what you can do within your centre of influence.
Well,
okay, so that, yeah.
So that is coming back to basket, because a company only does time and they say,
okay, so look, it's a big discussion about the salary. Let's go down the
There's something else. The banks have an opportunity. They see which small businesses are actually functioning well. And they have an opportunity to encourage those businesses. Grassroots level, and they actually do it. The bank managers out there, in the branches, trying to look for guys who...
Yeah, I know they're talking about it, like a more financially inclusive model. I mean, there's also trade-off with them, because there's more risk.
Yeah, but they're going to take the risk, but they're measuring their risk when they see the guys or...
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's look at it at a different idea, completely different idea. Gaurav Babastra. So, if we look at the second line from the top, Rav Begezel. So what the Gemara is saying is that most people are to be suspected of Gezel, of thievery. Okay, so what does that mean? So if you look at the second Rashi, last word on the top line, Rav Begezel. Says Rashi, Rav b'nei Adam chashudim al ha-gezel. The Gemara statement is that most people are to be suspected of thievery. A very harsh statement. So then Rashi qualifies it and he says, Ka'ein gezel. Which means to say, a type of gezel. Like Gezel, not Gezel in the most explicit, fully fledged sense, but a type of Gezel. And then Rashi says, Shemoyrin Hatira, the Masa or the Matan, that people are Moira Hatira, they engage in rationalizations or justifications when they are engaged in business. La'akev ish merevach ha'ra'ui lo l'chaveira, where a person acts in a way where he holds back the gain or the profit that was due to the other guy. Now, what you see in these two lines of Rashi is the most extraordinary depth, which anticipates our whole discussion now, which is really at the cutting edge of behavioral economics. So, let me speak it out that are related to Rashi. In economics, there was what was called a simple model of economic crime, called it the SMORC, which was developed in Chicago, and it basically posits that when people commit acts of thievery, financial dishonesty, they're motivated by a straightforward trade-off, cost versus benefit. In other words, how much money can I make versus what's the chances of me getting caught? And if I get caught, what is the scale of the punishment that I'm going to face? A standard financial motivation. Now, increasingly, that's been challenged by behavioral economists who say that people are not just motivated by that financial consideration, but also by a psychological one. Which means to say that there is this motivation to be dishonest, to make money in an illegal or unethical way. But, and people will for sure look at the consequences. What's the likelihood of getting caught? What's the punishment I'm going to face? But what people also have is the psychological consideration, which means to say they need to feel good about themselves. Now, this explains why people will often do things which are bad, but not so bad. So I'll give you an example. Insurance companies report that it's very unlikely or very unusual for people to fake an arson or a robbery and then go and claim some insurance. But what is very common is that people will exaggerate their losses by 10 to 15%. So in other words, I didn't arrange with my friends for my house to burn down. and then go and claim insurance. My house burned down. But my 32-inch television, but my 32-inch television became 40-inch. Or I didn't fake a robbery with my mates and then go and claim from insurance. But my wife's 18-carat gold necklace became 22-carat gold. That's very common. So why do people do it?
Because the insurance company are going to catch another...
So in one sense, it's easier to get away with. Sure. But in another sense, it's because people need to feel good about themselves. And so I'm prepared to do something which is sinful, but not absolutely sinful. So that 10 to 15% is within the range of sinful, but not absolutely sinful. Now, that's the first part of Rashi. If you read Rashi again. Most people are to be suspected of financial dishonesty. Mr. Shishan says this very explicitly. Talks about this, how we're imbued with this greed, which gets us to behave dishonestly. So he says, Ka'ain Gezel. Not Gezel in the fully fledged sense, but a form of it. So I think in business terms, what this often translates into is, CEO once told me, he says, I have a problem. I hire people to work till 5 o'clock on Friday. He's not talking about Shul Meshavis Jews, obviously. He says, but they typically leave at 2 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. Because they say, well, they've done their work. He says, I don't look at it that way. I've hired them to work till 5. So they're stealing from him, but that's Cain Gezel. They're not putting their hand into the into the cookie jar, but they're stealing from their employer, no question about it.
If they worked harder and they decided to work harder, they've done the good job.
But no, that's what they index. But okay, so we'll come to that in a minute. But he says, no, I don't care what you produce during the week, I want you in the office till 5 o'clock on Friday. That's your contract. I want you here till Friday, till 5 o'clock on Friday. I don't care what you've done. You know, you can't go over and have drinks at 2 o'clock on Friday afternoon because you've produced what you're supposed to produce. That's not the deal.
But couldn't have the opposite effect
that
the work will slow down?
That's his cash point. He's not he said, you've got to be it. But I'm saying that example of leaving early, which they full know is wrong, that's an example of Cain Gezel. Another example is you have in your expense claims. And you exaggerate. You throw in something which doesn't really belong there. Or free Wi-Fi. Or you take company stationery. One or two pencils so your kid can do his homework. Or you take a lunch break, which is a predominant. These are examples of Cain Gezel. But the point is, when the Gemara says, Rov Begezel, which is a very dramatic statement, you think, gosh, most people, you walk around. How many of us in the room? How many of us in the room? So, most of us would be suspected of Gezel. It's a very harsh statement. So Rashi explains what he's talking about. He's talking about the more insidious, that's the word I was looking for, the more insidious forms of Gezel. The more fully-fledged, no, that's likely to happen. It's the more insidious forms of Gezel that most people are susceptible to. And that I'm saying, fits in with what the insurance companies are saying, the 10 to 15%. They're not faking arsons and robberies. They're exaggerating 10 to 15%. You're stealing. But that's Cain Gezel. Why is it? Because people need to maintain their positive self-image. To go beyond that, they can't do. But here is the next stage. So if people need to maintain their positive self-image, and that's the only way they can do what they know is wrong, what does that then result in? What behavior does it result in? What? They have to rationalize. They have to justify. You call that being Moira Heta. That's the next line in Rashi. Says Rashi, Shemoira Hetira, the Master Bumatan. They are Moira Heta. What does Moira Heta mean? I justify it to myself. Why do I justify it to myself? Why do I rationalize it to myself? Because that's the only way I can maintain my positive self-image. So this is what Dana Reilly, the behavioral economist, who discovered through Peter Lotz, he was away in the had a big influence on the Shabbos project. He calls it the fudge factor. He talks about this delicate cognitive balancing act. When there's this financial motivation, like in that classic economic model, simple model of economic crime, I want to make money, but I'm also worried about getting caught and the consequences of that happening. But I've also got a psychological motivation. I need to feel good about myself. And so the only way I can do something which I know is wrong is through rationalizing it. So what are the common rationalizations? I should have brought it with me, but I saw the CFA Institute. The head of ethics in America wrote a list of common rationalizations in the financial services industry. And they were things like
rationalizations
for fine ethical behavior. Whatever it could be. It doesn't go into what they are, but they could be, you know, one of them is it won't hurt anyone. It's not a big deal.
Justice.
This is the way it's always been done. Everybody does it. If I don't do it, somebody else will. If we don't do it at our company, they'll do it at their company. I want to be a team player. I want to be loyal. All of these are common rationalizations or justifications. It's interesting, in South Africa, I heard they did a study where they found that these rationalizations are sometimes developed along the lines of race. So black people say it's okay for me to steal because I was oppressed. And white people say it's okay for me to steal because of affirmative action. Can't get ahead. You see, that's both rationalizations. So now let me ask you, what follows from this? In other words, what's the logical next step? If you say that people need to maintain their positive self-image, but they often are motivated to behave unethically, Rolf Begazel. And so the only way they can do it, the only way they can sort of reconcile the two is by rationalizing that bad behavior. What would you do to discourage unethical behavior? As a manager, what would you do?
Set an example.
Can you do that?
Increase their salaries.
Okay, you increase their salaries. So, one second. If you increase their salaries, you'd be addressing their financial motivation.
But it's like logical.
In other words, the more money I'm earning, I might be less motivated to steal. But I'm talking about addressing your psychological motivation. Well, this is the depth of the Gemara. The Gemara is telling you that people have, or Rashi is telling you rather, that people have a psychological motivation. Only recently being recognized or discovered in behavioral economics. But I'm saying, how would you address the psychological? Go through the different steps. I need to feel good about myself. But I want to take money in an unethical way. So what do I do to maintain myself positive image and get the money? I have to rationalize the bad behavior. Won't hurt anybody. It's immaterial. It's always been done this way. If I don't do it, someone else will. I can't get a job because of affirmative action. I've suffered because of apartheid, etc., etc. So what's the next step?
The mission is to accept as a boss that everybody steals. Everybody is very clear. For generations and generations, we always understood that all members of staff, or the great majority, steal.
That's like shrinkage, you write it off. Okay, but let's say you want to improve it.
To change the self-image.
Okay, but how will you change the self-image? It's like there's a simple step.
Giving me more results,
motivation.
Okay, but there's a little...
You know, it's just like you're having a discussion.
Just follow the logical flow here. I need to feel good about myself.
So you need more rationalization.
And the only way I can do it is by rationalizing my bad behavior. I'd be more a hater. Like Rashi's saying.
So what I do... What comes first, right? The guy does something, right? So then you say he has to feel good about himself, so he must rationalize.
Is that the logic of it?
Yeah.
Right? But then you need to also sit there and discuss it. And actually put it out there, just discuss it. See if these are the kind of things. A lot of people don't even think about it. We Jews, we think about it. We understand that there's such a thing as this type of gezel, right? And a lot of the problems is actually guys don't even think about it.
I think it's a beloved, you say it in a direct way. There's a direct answer, it's a one word answer.
So I think if you define, and what you're talking about is they have to be able to rationalize. Mm-hmm. If there's a conduct, ethics conduct, I don't know what the correct word is, but if you explain to your team.
Just forget that, just the principle. There's a principle here. If people need to rationalize their bad behavior to carry out the bad behavior, because they've got to look at themselves in the mirror, what would you do to discourage the bad behavior? It's a simple one line. But what would you do in the education? What would you focus on? That's already the how.
Defining what is moral and what isn't.
But what are you essentially doing?
Tapping,
I've got a rational thinking about myself. What are you going to do to stop me from doing that?
Consequences.
You have to challenge the rationalizations. You have to undermine the rationalizations.
You don't do the stuff.
What?
You need to.
You're getting into the how. Let's get the principle clear. I've got to feel good about myself. The only way I can do it is by rationalizing my bad behavior. If you want to reduce the likelihood of bad behavior, you have to undermine the rationalization. You have to challenge it.
So
here's the point. This is the crucial point. Much of ethics is not telling us what we don't know. It's reminding us of what we do know. Because by introducing those reminders, by confronting us with what we already know, you undermine the rationalizations. You make it difficult for people to do what's wrong and still feel good about themselves. What's the classic example in Torah of that? Classic example. I'll give you a clue. Tzitzis. We all know the famous story in the Gomorrah. The guy's about to do something bad and he gets hit by tzitzis. It's a reminder. Lahavdil. It's the same thing. People are being... You have to remind people of what they're not. Now, the next switch is how you do it. So that could be through training. Or it could be through reminders that you introduce into the workplace. Through signs or through rob, or whatever it is. That's the how.
You introduce guilt.
That's what guilt is. What guilt? Guilt is the result. But what's guilt? Guilt is when you have a... You have a tension between what people know is right and what they actually end up doing.
It is when the rationalization is not working anymore.
So by changing the rationalization, you play on the guilt. Absolutely. Guilt is conscience. Guilt just comes from conscience.
Sure.
That explains also by all sorts of things. I mean, why is it, have you ever wondered, when you are driving on the highway, you're going 145 kilometers an hour. There's a sign that says speed kills. You know speeding is dangerous. Why? People are being reminded of what they already know. Or, I haven't seen it for years, but you know, you go into a restaurant and you come out the bathroom and there's a sign directed at the kitchen staff saying, wash your hands before you go back to work. Now, I know I've been to the bathroom, and I know I have to wash my hands before I chop up your salad. So why are you telling me that? Often you have to remind people of what they already know. What you do by that is you make it harder for them to feel okay about themselves. And if they're rationalizations, you challenge them.
However, human beings, we are all animals of habit. Cities or not cities, washing hands or not washing hands, exceeding the speed limit, we need to constantly find new reminders. The stealing will continue.
Yes.
The bad behavior will continue. We need to break the feeling guilty in different ways on a continuous basis. That's my humble opinion.
Okay, so you can get into a whole discussion about the how, but I wanted to share with you that's a principle. And I think that principle you see in two lines of Russian.
I don't remember going to a job where the first thing the guy said to me is, listen, you're stationary over there, please use the stationary. Don't feel that you're stealing it. Expect you to use it, but be careful about it. And it's for the office use. In other words, you're going out there and saying, look, this is a thing, but even though it seems petty to you, I want you to feel free to use it, but don't abuse it.
Okay, that's his prerogative as a manager.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a sensitivity. A guy joins the office.
Yeah.
First thing that happens, he takes some stuff. She's not sure. Can I take it? Can I not? He's like making a decision. You know, he's already before he even starts the work. He had to take his pencil, and he wasn't sure when he could take it.
Right. So to go back to Jose Frank, in the case that I gave, then the manager wasn't Levante. He said, "No, I want you in the office for 5." So they were going ahead, and they rationalized to themselves by saying, "We've been so productive all week. We finished our work. We deserve to go early."
But doesn't it also depend on, going back to your question, the morals, the morality of the person? He can have certain morals and everything and up to a certain point. But if he's got no moral, then he's not going to, nothing's going to help.
Okay, absolutely.
Nothing's going to, sure, okay. So this is not 100%. This is not going to, this will help. This will be effective. But it's not ironclad. And I suppose we're going to run out of time. A lot more we can talk about. What we talk about in the next few minutes. The relates to your point, which is: do people know right from wrong? Do people know good from bad?
People know
right
from wrong. May I ask? The question that I need to ask, the living early, I got a certain view about living early, depends on which function the person is allocated and the size of the company. In a small company, I many times encourage people, particularly with long, lengthy times of transportation, I encourage people, if you achieve A or B or C, you can go earlier. They are getting paid on performance. I am a very great believer in performance, but when you have a factory of 50 or 100, everybody living early, it's a problem. Or people not maintaining discipline, it's a problem.
That's a particular issue. You can debate the ins and outs of it. Yeah, okay, that's it. I want to share with you a principle, how you then use it in practical application. That's for discussion. But let's perhaps relate to what's a very broad question. Do people know right from wrong, good from bad? So Rav Nissim Gaon in this Hakdama to the Shas. So this was thousand years ago. He writes that people have inbuilt, or if you like, a universal capacity for reason and understanding. And based on that universal capacity for reason and understanding, people do know, they're able to figure out the basic sense, right from wrong, good from bad. Right? So, that suggests that there is there's some kind of moral compass which is inbuilt, which is inherent in being a human being. So in a way, what this accords with is, let me just make a point, is that we all know, you know, they make the Shem's image, and the depth of that is that what is a Shem's central characteristic? One of the central characteristics is he's free. Hashem makes and destroys worlds. So he's free. He can do what he wants. So if we are made in Tzelem Elokim, we're made in his image, then in some sense we share that freedom. Obviously within our human constraints. Obviously not the same thing. But there is a certain freedom to choose. If we agree to choose, we then become responsible for our actions. Now it's interesting. I mean, we talk about modern research. There was a study done by three Harvard Business School professors where they analyzed 23 codes of conduct. 14 were from multinational companies. The others were from leading international institutions like OECD, Global Reporting Initiative.
They analyzed these 23 codes and found that there were 62 standards. And they then analyzed these 62 standards and found that there were 8 values or 8 ethical principles underlying them. And they ran a survey of 6,000 employees of multinational companies working in like 23 countries. So you had lots of diversity in terms of geography, in terms of culture, and in terms of grade. And they asked them 2 sets of questions. The first question was, to what extent do you think your company ought to adhere to these 62 standards and these 8 values? And the follow-up question was, to what extent does your company actually adhere? And what they found was with the first question, there was remarkable consensus. It suggested that there was this moral compass. People agreed. People had this very broad sense of how you should behave, cutting across geography, culture, grade, and so on. But what they also found was that in the follow-up question, the should question, to what extent does your company actually adhere, there they found there were lots of discrepancies on different parts of the world, different cultures, different grades. They found that people higher up had a more positive view of companies and those lower down. Now, I think that this, in a way, illustrates, not that you need a corroboration of what we're saying. People basically know right from wrong. The problem comes with the follow-up. And this is where I think a crucial insight into human nature is that we have this amazing ability to live with contradictions. People on the whole know what's right. That's what Rav Nissen-Gaon was saying. But they have this enormous ability to behave in a way which is contrary to what they know is right. What makes them do that? Well, it's a combination of pressures and temptations. Pressures are when you've got your back against the wall. Pressures when I'm going to feed my family. You know, my uncle, I'll save this on your recording, is a CEO of a business bank. So for years, he's been lending money to businesses. And I always remember him telling me, since I was a kid, how he would have clients who had always been honest and trustworthy, but then their business would get into trouble, and the pressure was on. And then, you know, how am I going to support my family? They're going to come and take my house. And then they start ducking and diving and behaving in all sorts of dishonest ways. Temptations are different. Temptations have to do with greed or ego. It's not I've got my back against the wall. It's not that I've got pressure on me. I'm in a corner. It's I want more and more. That's like what the Mrs. Sharma speaks about. There's greed for more and more. You take Arthur Andersen. KPMG are in all sorts of trouble. Arthur Andersen was one of the big 5 accounting firms, right? KPMG, Arthur Andersen, Deloitte, EY, and PwC. Collapsed due to a series of accounting scandals, the most serious of which was with Enron. The year before Enron's collapse, you know how much money Arthur Andersen was making from them? $25 million in auditing fees, $27 million in consulting fees. Now, if you pay me $52 million in 1 year, I've got a very strong temptation to ignore your concealment of billions of dollars of debt from your shareholders, which is what they did. So pressures and temptations have this enormous ability to get people to behave in a way which they know is wrong, which goes against the moral compass. And people have this amazing ability to deliver contradictions. That's why it says in Pirkei Avos, "V'al tamin ba'atzmecha ad yom moscha." Don't believe in yourself until the day of your death. That's an incredibly profound statement. Don't believe in yourself until the day of your death means you can be a good person, but you still have that potential for ethical failure. You see, we often have this oversimplified view of human nature. Good people will always or necessarily carry out good actions. Bad people will always or necessarily carry out bad actions. What's wrong with that? Good people, because of pressures and temptations, are capable of behaving badly. And that's the depth of what Chazal's saying. So, to kind of pull together some of the strands of what's a very broad subject, I think people on the whole do have a small compass that you see from Isengard writing 1,000 years ago. But when it comes to their actual behavior, so then you're going to have discrepancies. You're going to have more failures in some places than other places. And what often drives those failures is how people have pressures and temptations. And you can have a situation where even good people can behave badly. Those guys who, those clients of the bank who started behaving dishonestly, were they bad people? Probably not. They were good people who, because of pressure, ended up behaving badly. Don't trust yourself until they've been there. We all have that potential. And so part of ethics, now that we run out of time, is to work on trying to achieve more congruence, more alignment, that we know is right, what we actually do.
Say before, because when he's under pressure, he now can justify to himself. He can still maintain and refer to the positive self-image.
Yeah, positive self-image.
Because the reason I'm only doing this is because I'm under this pressure.
Right, exactly.
So they, because I'll...
That could be a way of doing it, yeah.
Or because the pressure comes up with another rationalization, but yeah, these things fit together. Okay, shkak everybody. Good discussion.
Shkak, yes. Appreciate that you shared with us. It's been a pleasure. From 10 years.